Tobacco Survey and provide some basic framework for which you can plan, implement the surveillance system within tribal communities. And I kind of hope to put together something that would really be useful so that when you were thinking about the planning process, you'd have a way to think about some of the things that need to be in place prior to implementation and direct implementation. I specifically work with the Northern Plains Tobacco Prevention Project, which is an initiative of our health board that specifically addresses the issue of chronic commercial tobacco use in the Northern Plains. Our organization has really three approaches to trying to promote positive change within our communities. The first is providing training and technical assistance for tribal communities and tribal programs to plan, implement, evaluate, and sustain comprehensive tobacco programs. The second is through strategic planning, where we are responsive to what our consortium members feel are important needs within the community and developing a plan that reduces the overall burden that commercial tobacco plays within the communities. And also through the coordination of regional and intertribal initiatives that are evidence-based. Some of the benefits for conducting the American Indian Adult Tobacco Survey include, Stacy talked about some of the problems with the data that are available from national and state surveillance systems. And so the American Indian Adult Tobacco Survey gives us the ability to have better quality data, data that's representative and tribally specific. It also establishes a baseline against which we can measure future progress. It provides insight into the social norms and the effectiveness of tobacco controls impact within those tribal communities. It identifies areas of strength and opportunity that we can draw on. When reporting back our data to the tribal councils, we didn't just report the prevalence data, but we also looked at what were the opportunities that the data showed us. It identifies, it allows stakeholders to evaluate tribally based programs. In other words, it just lets us know if we're, you know, how we're doing and where we need to go. Some of the specific aims that our communities implemented the survey for were primarily to empower tribes to effectively engage in surveillance and monitoring of attitudes, behaviors, beliefs related to tobacco use. Again, to provide representative and tribally specific data, to provide data that allowed tribes to set health priorities, and then to substantiate the need for continued access to tobacco control resources. And then the last aim was to provide data that informed the development of tribal policies that aim to reduce the consumption of tobacco products and the public's exposure to secondhand smoke. And we implemented this survey with five of our consortium member tribes, two in 2005, Cheyenne River and Sisseton, and three with our North Dakota tribes in 2007, Standing Rock, Spur Lake, and the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara Nation. And so this gives you an idea, this gives you an idea of where the tribes are located. Our communities are very large land-based tribes, so one consideration that you may have when implementing is what's the geographic of the tribe that you're working with. If you're working with large land-based tribes like we did, some of these methods would be very appropriate. However, if you're in a non-land-based tribe, then you may have to think of alternatives. alternative methodologies in terms of sampling and finding appropriate denominators. Prior to implementing the American Indian Adult Tobacco Survey, there are a few things that states and non-tribal programs should really consider before implementation. First, you want to be able to identify and develop strong tribal partnerships, and these partnerships really should be in place before too much effort and too much time has spent on developing your study. You want to obtain formal tribal IRB approval, also prior to groundwork. You want to develop a data sharing agreement with the tribes that are going to participate so that there's a clear understanding of how the data is going to flow and who's going to have ownership of the data after the results are in. You want to work with tribal partners to select supplementary questions that are best suited for the community. And a very important consideration is selecting appropriate contractors who have the knowledge, skills, and abilities to navigate tribal systems and maintain rigorous protocol required by population-based research. And then lastly, you want to make sure that you're using the CDC implementation manual and the tribal consultation policies when working with tribes. There are a few things that tribal programs need to consider prior to implementation, and you want to be sure that funding, adequate funding, is identified and leveraged to allow the survey to be implemented from the planning to the final reporting stage. Also keeping in mind the expenses of putting the data to action following the receipt of the survey data. Also, in thinking about the contractors who are actually going to implement, we also want to keep in mind that there are rich resources with the IHS-funded tribal epidemiology centers who may be able to provide support, as well as the CDC-funded tribal support centers who have experience in conducting the survey. Also, in developing the survey questionnaire that's going to be specific to the community, the supplemental questions are also very important to consider which ones are going to be included, keeping in mind some of the health risks that that are in addition to tobacco, commercial tobacco consumption. In terms of the tribal approval process, there are two major entities that you would have to get approval from. And first is the tribal approval system, the tribal governments. And every tribal system is really unique. And so the process is going to be a little bit different from tribe to tribe. But this slide kind of outlines just a basic structure of approval, which I think really begins with communication with tribal leaders and or the governing health committees, and then followed by the approval from the elected committee, or followed by the tribal council itself. And really beginning conversations with the elected health committees is really important because they can help you approach the tribal council at large. And so if you kind of have their buy-in from the beginning, they'll be able to help you throughout the entire process of the study. And then the second entity is the IRB approval, and the consideration there is whether or not the tribal government has an IRB or doesn't have an IRB. And in the case that they do, be very appropriate to go through the tribal IRB system to get the IRB approval. However, if they don't, the IHS IRB approval system is what we would recommend going through to get the institutional review board approval. In terms of adding supplemental questions, it's a really an excellent opportunity to demonstrate the responsiveness to tribal concerns. One of the things that we can consider is where does the tribe need additional data? For instance, in some of our studies, when we're looking at analyzing the results, there are certain factors that may be confounded that if you don't consider beforehand, like maybe height and weight, and some other of the typical risk factors that you might want to consider looking at to be able to determine what the data is telling us. And so we want to, when thinking about adding the supplemental questions, we want to review the supplemental questions provided by the implementation manual, followed by reviewing some of the surveys with systematic question evaluation procedures, and they can be found in the CDC EPI and question appraisal system. And this system really provides a checklist of 8 possible problems and many subtypes and examples that you can come in, that you can encounter when developing questions. One of the things that would be discouraged is just creating additional questions that haven't really been evaluated for their content or how the community will respond to them. When beginning to think about sampling, the issue of denominator is definitely going to come up, and perhaps identifying a comprehensive sampling frame is going to be one of the single greatest challenges to implementing the surveillance system. For the most part, telephone sampling is considered to be inappropriate for most population-based tribal surveillance. And so there are 4 real denominator options that you would have to consider. The first is the most common, and that's choosing a denominator that is consists of tribal members residing within land boundaries. The second is all enrolled tribal members, and that one I think would probably pose the greatest challenge. Third, all American Indians residing within land boundaries of that particular community. And then fourth, all individuals residing within the land boundaries. And keeping in mind that data can be disaggregated in the latter 2 examples. I think for most of the, all of the 10 tribes chose the first denominator to be in. In terms of sampling methodology, there were really 2 approaches that we used. In 2005, we used random sampling from a list, and common lists that can be used are tribal enrollment records, tribal census data, and per capita lists, and housing composition lists. And I think it's really important that we, before we actually go through the effort of getting a list to sample from, that we identify whether or not that list is going to be comprehensive and up to date. And some of the lists that are maybe maintained by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, some of them may not be up to date, or they may not be comprehensive of the denominator that you are looking for. So definitely want to consider some of those issues. The second approach that that we used in 2007 was random sampling from houses, which I think it's very comprehensive. However, there are some concerns that arise from multiple family units and the complexity of large land-based tribes, making sure that we're not leaving out people who live in some of the rural locations. And individuals with the random house sampling, individuals in the homes can be further randomized once the houses have been selected. When thinking about determining the sample size and number of completes, I guess the quick answer is the sample size should be as many as you can afford to complete. However, the sample size and the target number of completed surveys, in reality, when we're considering budget constrictions, should really be justified by the precision to which we want our data to accurately reflect the population. And we typically think of having a margin of error of 5 or less as being as a goal. In terms of some of the cost per survey, we found that the survey cost about $35 to $55 per survey, and which I think the standard state ATS is about $35 per survey. And when we did our analysis of the cost of actually implementation, I think because this is a fairly new instrument that hasn't been fielded before, also the methodology is very different from some of the state and national surveillance, there hasn't really been a refined method of actual implementation. And I think as we develop more efficient methods to implement the survey, I think the cost will be comparable to the state, if not even lower than some of the state-based surveillance. One of the key pieces to actually successfully implementing the survey is having a strong interview team. And in our experience, the interviewers really should be selected from the communities from which the data is going to be taken. And the role of the interviewer is really different. The role of the interview is really different when you're comparing it to state and national level surveillance. Typically, we don't think about the interviewer as having that great an impact on the overall success of the project. However, for our experience and for the American Indian Health Tobacco Survey, the role of the interviewer is really unparalleled. Interviewers should have experience with implementing systematic protocols, and our interviewers had previous experience with Census 2000, voter registration, tribal census, and medical interview. Our interviewers assisted in identifying unreachable people and development of the master sample frame. So in many cases, when we developed that master sample frame, we were able to sit down with our team of interviewers and identify individuals in the sample who had passed on, were in military service, or otherwise unreachable, which really saved a lot of time and energy in terms of the work that we had to do. This is just a picture of our interviewer, part of our interviewer team from 2005. Representing the Sisseton, Wahpeton, and Cheyenne River nations. When fielding the ATS, the cultural competency of the interviewer team is an absolute essential. We used tribal radio and newspapers to announce the beginning of the fielding process. In 2007, where we used the household base sampling methodology, we really relied heavily on tribal radio to announce where in the community, which district in the community that we would be in. So, for instance, if we were in White Shield and we were planning to go to Banderee, at 1 o'clock we'd call the radio station and we'd say, you know, we're going to be in Banderee at 1 o'clock, and they'd announce it. So actually, when our interviewing teams went to Banderee, many of the people in the community already knew we were going to be there, and so that I think that really increased the comfort level of the interviewee. In terms of the time it takes for completion, we found that on average the survey takes about 10 to 15 minutes to complete. However, many participants want to engage in the conversation or share their personal, even sometimes medical histories with the interviewers, and of course interviewers are trained on how to deal with that. And it's really appropriate to let people voice, you know, their concerns or share their history. And that obviously takes more than 10 to 15 minutes. So a 10 to 15 minute interview can easily turn into a 30 to 40 minute interview if the interviewer isn't able to really navigate in and out of the interviewing situation. One of the things that we kind of learned as we went along is considering the safety of the interviewers and developing contingency plans. Looking at, and I'll talk a little bit more about the contingency plans in the next, not in this slide, but in the next slide. But looking at some of the methods that motivated individuals. In 2005, we used cash compensations, which we found to be extremely motivating. We didn't have any refusals when using the $25 cash incentive. And in 2007, we used 60-minute calling cards, which we found to be slightly less effective, but still slightly less motivating, but still effective at achieving pretty decent response rates. So some of the unexpected things to plan for, and these are the things that we kind of learned as we went along, and really developing a contingency plan. So as you and maybe your contractor are thinking about how you're going to implement, you definitely want to think about some of the contingencies that may come up. For instance, we're in the Northern Plains, which means we need to consider weather as a factor. I think on this day, the weather, no, I'm sorry, not on this day. There's another, reaffiliated when we were in the Mandan and Hidatsa River Nation. The very last day of implementation, it was 40 degrees below zero. And so we had to kind of think about how are we going to deal with that with the reality that we needed to achieve a certain response rate. And so we were able to just get by. So you definitely consider the weather. You want to think about certain things in the community that normal researchers may not be considering, such as dogs, which we had a very interesting experience with. And also the long distances between the survey site and central locations, maybe the location of the hotel or eating locations. And in parentheses here, I said, your interviewer team will want to eat lunch by noon, but they're definitely going to demand to have their lunch by 5. So you really can't push them much past 5 o'clock. So I think in our experience, I did go with the team to a couple of the locations, and I was able to actually do some interviews myself. And so by 3 o'clock, everybody was like, well, you know, baby, I'm kind of getting hungry. Okay, we'll go eat. And then by 5, you know, baby, it's 5 o'clock now, we really need to go eat something. One of the other things that we found is that in terms of the communities and also the length of the survey, we found a great number of people were willing to actually feed interviewer teams. So in many cases, it wasn't that serious of an issue because we were actually provided food by the community. And also, there's no cell phone reception, which does pose some problems for the safety of the interviewers. So those are just some things to think about. And so I put, this is not telephone surveillance. And this picture here kind of gives an example of the fact that this is not telephone surveillance that we're doing. And so lastly, I just want to talk about some of the obligations to tribal communities post the survey. And I think it's really important that many researchers come into the tribal community to collect the data and go. And so I think it's important that before you even begin, you should have a plan of how you want to disseminate the information back to the community and make sure that you're talking with the health committees, the governing health committees and tribal councils about how you're going to communicate both to them and the communities at large. And so, of course, you have to get permission before you publish anything, any data. But some of the different communication strategies are to develop fact sheets and op-ed articles that can go in tribal publications. And also, there's a very rich opinion data piece within the survey, which actually can give tribal members a strong voice about how they feel about smoking in public places. And this information can definitely be communicated back to tribal leadership about what their constituency, how their constituency feels about policy and other opinions. And then ensure that when you're presenting the data back, that the actual community doers are in attendance so that they can actually take action on your recommendations. And then it's important that you provide clear recommendations that can empower the stakeholders to actually move on the data.